broadcasting live from Forward Observer Central Command in Austin, Texas. It's the man always out front on issues. You're listening to Out Front with Mike Shelby.
All right. Hello and good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Out Front. I'm your host, Mike Shelby. As a reminder, my show notes are posted over at Forward Observer for subscribers. You can support the show and get my show notes at forwardobserver.com/subscribe. All right. On today's show, we're talking about Russian nukes, what the CIA director said today about World War III. Senator Lindsey Graham-Nisty went over to Taiwan. I'll tell you what the Chinese did in response. And if we get through all that, I'll get to your questions. But first, today's shout out of the day goes to Zoltan Pozar. The great Zoltan. Oh, this side. Oh, there we go. All right, Ben did that. He is the head of short-term interest rates over at Credit Suisse. That's a very boring name, but don't let that fool you, because he has been covering some very interesting stuff, including this concept of Bretton Woods 3. Now, back in March, Pozar made the financial world do a double take. He started talking about this new world monetary order that stemmed from Russian sanctions due to the Ukraine war. He wrote, quote, "We are witnessing the birth of Bretton Woods III, a new world monetary order centered around commodity-based currencies in the East that will likely weaken the Euro-dollar system and also contribute to inflationary forces in the West," end quote. Bretton Woods I, 1944, established the U.S. dollar as the new global reserve. Bretton Woods II, so the theory goes, was in 1971 when Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard. And now we're at Bretton Woods III. So we've gone from establishing the U.S. dollar as the world reserve to what was then a gold-backed dollar and then a fiat dollar, and now Bretton Woods III, which is the dollar in decline, moving to a gold-backed or oil-backed or some basket of commodities-backed currency that I've been talking about. Russia's really been pushing this. Russia's been pushing for the BRICS to adopt a commodity-backed currency. I've been talking about that, I think it was yesterday or maybe the day before. At any rate, the great Zoltan says, this is bigger than Nixon taking the dollar off the gold standard in 71. And he's also shorting the dollar. In a note to clients published on Tuesday, he continued saying that the Russia-Ukraine war does indeed mark the end of globalization, something I discussed in this morning's weekly economic outlook over for Forward Observer subscribers. On the high side, talked briefly about how the world is fracturing in the geopolitical spheres, much like it did back during the Cold War between the United States and the USSR. That is happening. And I just have to ask, is this a Cold War that the United States is going to win? We are so incredibly polarized here in this country. We're trapped in a low-intensity conflict that in earnest began in 2016, maybe as early as 2008 with the great financial crisis. And I really do not see a way to get out of this before it getting worse. And of course, I've made my thoughts known on 2024, 2025. Numerous times. And this is why we're talking about the great Zoltan and what comes next for the quote unquote rules-based international order and also the global dollar monetary system. Pozar brings up the importance of statecraft, and he says that this new monetary system, whatever it's going to end up being, probably anchored in the East, i.e. with China and maybe Russia, you know, and maybe India, I don't know, who knows. That's 3 billion people right there, roughly. So, or at least 2.5 billion people. So, let's mention this about Russia. Everyone you kind of poo-poos the Russian economy. I mean, it's no longer the 11th largest economy in the world, but prior to the war, it was. And everyone says, well, it's only the, you know, they got an economy the size of Italy's economy. And, you know, that was true up until a month or two ago. However, they were still the 11th largest economy. So I don't think that's anything really to shake a stick at. Relative to China and the U.S., yeah, sure. I mean, they dwarf the Russian economy. but the Russian economy was still the 11th largest in the world. At any rate, the great Zoltan says that this is the next monetary order is not going to be decided by central banks, but it's going to be decided by statecraft, the people who are in charge, the people at the top. And he cites this, and he does a great job. He brings up Mohammed bin Salman, who's the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And actually, Ben, if you've got that quote up there. Earlier this year, Ben Salman was asked about U.S. investment, because one of the things that really ticked the Saudis off is the Biden administration chose Iran as its racehorse in the Middle East. They said, look, we solved the Iran problem. We can, you know, quote unquote, solve the Iran problem. Then we can bring peace in the Middle East. And apparently that's the Biden strategy, and that's their intent, at least. Well, that really rubbed the Saudis the wrong way. And when asked about Saudi investments in the United States, which I believe something like $800 billion, so almost $1 trillion, he says, in the same way we have the possibility of boosting our interests, i.e. in the U.S., we have the possibility of reducing them. And back, if you'll remember, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 weeks ago, when Mohammed bin Salman said that the Saudis maybe, or they're at least considering selling oil to China priced in Chinese yuan, that rattled a lot of people in money. And, you know, that was kind of a freak out moment for some people. And I, at the time, I didn't know how serious he was about that. And I remember saying, you know, they may do that, but I don't see it happening at the rate that other people do, because I think the Saudis, you know, who was it the other day? I think it was the Brazilian or maybe Indian official said, look, we're not completely leaving the U.S. sphere of influence, because it's really hard to undo that once you go that way. So even if the Saudis are displeased with the Biden administration, look, maybe the Biden administration might get the boot in another, I don't know, 2.5 years. So I don't think maybe the Saudis want to take like a 100-year bet on something that could change radically in terms of U.S. policy in the next 2.5 years. At any rate, on the topic of the Saudis, we've talked about this before, and my question is, if the Saudis can remove their investment, turn a 180, start to reduce their investment in the United States in favor of investing more heavily in China, if they can do that with their investments, why can't they do that with their diplomatic and geopolitical power? And the answer is, there is no good answer. They absolutely could do that. And that's probably what China's BRICS plan is counting on, that a lot of these countries like Saudi Arabia, kind of in the periphery, are going to do that. At any rate, the great Zoltan continues. He says, quote, luck is running out. Central banks were lucky to have price stability as a tailwind when they had to fight crises of foreign exchange pegs, par repo, and the cash futures basis. Those were the easy crises, the ones you can print your way out of with quantitative easing, but not this time around. He continues, you can't quantitatively tighten or hike your way out of this current crisis easily. And if you can't, credibility gets damaged. A decline of the U.S. dollar is inevitable, and shorting U.S. rates, the U.S. dollar, and some foreign exchange pegs makes logical sense. And in this, he's writing for, by the way, he's not just some guy with a blog. He's works over at Credit Suisse. So a pretty big financial name talking about this stuff. That's my shout out of the day, because I think he's right on the money. No pun intended. All right, let's talk briefly. I did not watch the speech. I also haven't seen the transcript, but CIA Director William Burns gave a speech today, and he said United States intel to Ukraine has been vital in the conflict over there. He also said that the United States was deeply concerned about avoiding a third world war and avoiding a threshold where nuclear weapons could be used. I have no further information on this. I just read it off the wire. All right, let's move on now to the China Daily Press briefing here. A couple of interesting notes. So every day, the Chinese Foreign Ministry gives this presser over in China. And look, it's just a massive propaganda effort. I couldn't even tell you that this press conference actually literally takes place. I can't tell you that for certain. And a lot of these questions, A lot of these questions they ask really makes me wonder. At any rate, the first question in the Chinese foreign, with all the stuff going on in the world, today's first question for the Chinese foreign ministry spokes dude, his name is Zhao Lijian. The first question was about Black Americans. And he was asked if China had any comment on what's happening with voting rights and voting power of Black Americans that have been restricted in America. And I'll tell you what he had to say, but he could have literally just read this response straight out of the Washington Post. He said, quote, "The utopia," as in the American utopia, "the utopia depicted by words is shattered by reality." And then he goes on to quote Martin Luther King Jr. and talks about how the United States should look to solve its own problems before branching out and accusing others, like, you know, Chinese, the Uyghur concentration camps and all that stuff. This is like the same stuff every day, but actually gets a lot worse from here, because another question was whether the Chinese foreign ministry has any thoughts about some racist remarks about Ukraine. You may remember a couple of journalists said they were aghast at what was happening in Ukraine, because this is not the Middle East. This is not Central Africa. This is a semi-European nation, they said. And he was asked if the Chinese ministry had any comments on that. Also, Lindsey Graham-nisty is in Taiwan, maybe right now, meeting with officials there. And the Chinese, I noticed, were a little less aggressive, a little less threatening today about this. Maybe they thought they overdid it when they spoke out against Pelosi. But Jha did warn the United States to, quote, "avoid going further down the dangerous path," end quote, of Taiwanese independence. By the way, go ahead and drop your questions and comments over. Oh, someone says there's no YouTube. I don't know. Ben, you want to look into that? I have no idea. Sorry. Well, I guess we're not doing questions today if there's no comments over here in YouTube. Not sure what happened. All right. I don't know. It says refresh, but I'm not able to see comments either. Hang on. Let me see if I can pop this back open. Oh, there we go. Okay. Apparently you just have to refresh. So, all right. Let me get back situated here. All right. The next item on the list today, just going down the list, Russia threatens to deploy nukes. Russia said they would deploy nuclear weapons this is not like they're going to fire off nukes necessarily, although I don't think they will, but they could. Russia says they will deploy nuclear weapons if Sweden and Finland join NATO. According to this statement from Dmitry Medvedev, he says, quote, "naturally, we have to reinforce these borders." And he's talking about reinforcing the borders. They're reinforcing borders with Finland specifically. He says, "we have to reinforce these borders. In this case, it would not be possible to talk anymore about the Baltic non-nuclear status. The balance has to be restored," end quote. Now, you may recall, there's this tiny little piece of land. It's not that tiny. Called Kaliningrad, and it is Russian sovereign territory. It's on the Baltics. And there were rumors there several years ago about Russia deploying nuclear-tipped caliber missiles there. And a lot of people have said, hey, I thought the Russians already had nukes in the Baltics. And what it appeared to me is that Russia is saying that they're going to have to use strategic nuclear forces to reinforce their border with Finland, which is a new border. It's new territory, slightly new part of the world. And I don't think this is just old news piling on top of old news. I think this is maybe this becomes a game of chicken here. At any rate, it's not looking great for Russia right now with Sweden and Finland. Apparently they're going to join NATO within weeks, maybe even next month. All right. With that, let's get, go ahead and post your questions in the chat. We'll get to them. And oh, yeah, there's a comment saying, really, you're coming out with this now. This has been our face for 20 to 30 years. Yeah, So look, everyone's been talking about the demise of the dollar for, I know, for ages. It's not new. I understand that. Credit Suisse coming out, the great Zoltan coming out and talking about this is that is new. The idea of commodities-based currency that could be an alternative to the U.S. dollar that doesn't live in the Western Hemisphere, but lives in the Eastern Hemisphere. This is a new development. So the concept of the dollar decline, yeah, that's not new, obviously. J.P. Morgan did that study where they found that currencies last as the global reserve for somewhere between 80 and 110 years. That's been the case going back to the 1300s with the Portuguese real. So yeah, that's not new. You know, 20 to 40 years, I think, is the timeline for the U.S. dollar. Maybe 40 years is a little generous. Certainly within 20 years, potentially within the next five, the U.S. dollar it could start losing enough strength where people really start to question, is this still a global reserve? But look, for China, they don't have to 100% displace the dollar. All they have to do is offer an alternative. And that may be what Zoltan Pozsar is talking about here, is this commodities-based currency that's backed by gold, backed by oil, backed by a basket of currencies that that may become kind of a standard of trade for the BRICS, even if they don't use the digital yuan, which I think is what China prefers them to use. But thanks for the comment there. Let's see, Ben has some questions over here in the chat. How does China's starving citizens benefit them? Less mouths to feed in the recession, or a convenient way to stop supplying us? Yeah, so I know that Ross Kennedy and a couple of other people, by the way, it's Man Integrated. He's the over on Twitter. If you're on Twitter, that's where he tweets. He has talked about the Chinese using these COVID shutdowns as gray zone warfare against the United States. There's not a lot of speculation. There's been some warnings recently. We've reported on this like in the past couple of weeks about once the pandemic restrictions in Shanghai or in other regions of China, once those are lifted, you're going to have, allegedly, they're going to have this mass rush container ships coming out of there. And so now there's talk about the, you know, major ports in the Pacific, LA and Long Beach, again, going through that massive backlog. I don't know how accurate, how real that will end up being, but some people have been talking about this being gray zone warfare being used by China. What I think makes the most sense is China's, like I said a couple of days ago, there are some alternative explanations for why China is shutting down Shanghai. After thinking about it and reading a couple of different takes, I actually think that they don't want to overwhelm their healthcare system, frankly. And that's my guess as to the real story about why Chinese Communist Party is shutting down Shanghai. And yeah, there have also been claims that China's going through food shortages, and that one reason they're locking them down and kind of rationing out food is because they've run out of food. I don't know how accurate that is either, but that's also an interesting take. All right. Next question. Does the CCP make a move on Taiwan because population issues? I don't think because population issues. I think a military invasion of Taiwan is preferable only to not doing anything with Taiwan. I think, you know, in terms of course of action, potential courses of action, the very bottom is China does nothing on Taiwan. The next level up above that is China military invades. And then you've got this whole range of potential courses of action where China uses diplomatic, political pressure, economic pressure, so on and so forth, and tries to bring Taiwan to heel, or at least erodes their ability or erodes their willingness to resist. It doesn't mean that China will never military invade. I just think right now they're not in a place to do that. All right. Any other questions? I don't see anything crazy popping up on my feeds here. Let's go ahead and talk about this. I guess everyone saw Elon Musk made a bid to buy Twitter. Not going to happen, I guess. How large of a U.S. House majority will Republicans need to do nothing? Yes. What will make China invade Taiwan? The only thing that is going to maybe register for the Chinese is Taiwan getting the Taiwanese separatists or Taiwanese independence movement, maybe making, maybe making some concrete steps to, you know, officially declare, or really just to kind of flaunt flaunt their independence. And I think that's the only thing. Look, you look at what China has been doing, especially for emerging markets that want Chinese and money and want Chinese investment to come in to help for the Chinese to build their critical infrastructure. China's been basically trading investment for cutting diplomatic ties with Taiwan. And I think they did, was it Ecuador, or there's some smaller South American country they did that to just a year, 6 months ago or something like that. So I think China's, China doesn't have to do this by next month. China doesn't have to do this by next year. They don't have to do this in 5 years. And I think China's plan is to continually wear down Taiwan until they're able to do that. And maybe there probably will be the military involved. They're, like Max said, I don't know, last year sometime, that probably the most probable course of action at this point is when they do decide to take Taiwan, it's a naval blockade as opposed to, amphibious landings. So I think that's kind of where China is. As for China relies on the USA for food, USA could literally turn China off if it decided to. Yeah, that would be a Pyrrhic victory. I mean, anything that the United States does against China can be reciprocated because China holds $1 trillion, roughly. I think it's something like $1 trillion worth of our debt. They make a ton of our stuff. It would be very, very difficult. I mean, if there was an immediate decoupling from China and the United States, it would be so painful for both. It'd probably put both of us into a depression. So I don't think there's, I just, at this point, I don't think there's a risk of like an immediate, the U.S. says, okay, China, we're tired of you doing X, Y, or Z, and we're going to cut you off. It'd be very, very bad for the United States too. Your thoughts on what actions Russia takes regarding Sweden and Finland joining NATO? Well, that's a great question. I want to say back in 2017, maybe 2018, I'm fairly certain Putin came out and said, look, that's a red line. We're going to war. If Sweden or Finland joins NATO, that's a declaration of war. And so I don't know. I honestly, I'm not sure what he's going to do. Here's the real problem. The Russians may not even really understand what they're going to do, or they may not have chosen what they're going to do yet. So, I think this is very up in the air, and it's this kind of uncertainty that really concerns me. Because when you have a playbook or you have a plan and you're executing everything to a T, clearly the Russians have not been able to do this in Ukraine. And now Sweden and Finland, previously they said, no, we're not joining Ukraine, but we'll keep an open mind in the future. And then all of a sudden, like pretty swiftly, they said, yeah, we're going to join NATO. That kind of deviation also concerns me, because now we're getting into a level of very high uncertainty. And just like a war with China, I think a war with Russia is if we do go to war with Russia, if NATO or Russia goes to war with one or the other, it may be due to a miscalculation about the other's intent, as opposed to, well, let's just go to war with NATO next Tuesday. That's my take on it. But I am very concerned. Listen, this is one reason why I've asked Dustin to start writing a daily NATO-Russia sit rep again, because, and not on the tactical level, but with a specific focus on what's happening at the operational and strategic level between NATO and Russia, because that does concern me greatly. In my brief to Ford Observer subscribers today, I'll just say this one thing. I said that was my number one concern in the world right now is Russia-Ukraine expanding outside of Ukrainian borders. Next question. Wouldn't a China blockade involve invading the Senkaku Islands in the north, which is Japanese owned. Wouldn't that? Okay. No, the Chinese aren't going to have to invade the Senkaku Islands. I think it's the Russians and Japanese have that dispute. Let me bring up my map here. But yeah, if the yeah, there's also like the Kuril Islands, I want to say, or Kuril Islands. Yeah, I think that's between Russia and Japan. So, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. I don't think, I'm trying to recall, Max actually wrote about this last year. And maybe, yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, Senkaku's Taiwan and China. I don't know. I'll have to get Max back with you about that. I forgot what he wrote in his report last year. All right. Does this Russia strike before the application is approved? That's a possibility. If Russia thinks that NATO is going to war, if Russia believes that NATO is going to pursue regime change aggressively after they bring Sweden and Finland into this, that they, you know, there may be a preemptive strike. I don't know, but that's a potential course of action. Does the strike from Ukraine into Russia escalate military operations? Absolutely. So I don't know how real this is, but I said on this morning's early warning or daily essay that the Russians are accusing Ukrainian helicopters again of flying into Russian airspace. And reportedly launched an attack and killed some civilians again, allegedly, according to Russian media. I think I read that in the Moscow Times that. Yeah, I don't recall the village, but yeah, that is being reported. And yeah, Dustin and I both agreed today that between the near sinking of the of that flag, Russian Navy flagship and this another alleged attack. Yeah, I mean, I just don't see the Russians backing down after this. I think it escalates. All right. Let me look here at another, any other question. All right. Well, I think that's going to just about do it for us today. Yeah. Cliff says Article 5 is no guarantee of help. I agree. There's there are a number of NATO analysts who say that Article 5 is not a sure thing. Article 5 doesn't necessarily mean that all of NATO goes to war with Russia in this case. So I think that's an interesting take as well. All right. Well, gang, that's going to do it for me. I appreciate the support. If you want to get access to my show notes and also support our mission here at Forward Observer, you can do that at www.forwardobserver.com/subscribe. Certainly would appreciate your support. And Dustin will be back on the Daily SA show tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Central. I'll be back here at 2 p.m. Central. So until then, be well and stay out front.